Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is 5 o'clock and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Next up, we will be playing a recording called The Global Eco Crisis, Is It Too Late? This was a public lecture by Dr. David Suzuki that he gave on the 3rd of November, 2011, at the Chan Center here at UBC. And CITR recorded this lecture, and this lecture was funded by the Office of the Vice President Research and International, the Office of the Provost, and the UBC Sustainability Initiative. On November 25th, Dr. David Suzuki will be conferred with an honorary degree by UBC, and the ceremony, like all graduations, will be webcast. For more information on that ceremony, please go to www.graduation.ubc.ca. So now we will listen to the recording.
So I'd like to thank filmmaker Bruce Marchfeller and the USI staff for that wonderful video. Today is also the first day of an ambitious conference entitled Celebrating Sears, Accelerating Sustainability. The delegates in attendance today are committed to advancing the debates, technologies, discoveries, and instruction that will support a sustainable future. So thanks to all of the delegates from around the world for being with us tonight. It's my great pleasure now to introduce to you one of the most notable members of the UBC community. Dr. David Suzuki is co-founder of the Vancouver-based David Suzuki Foundation and is an award-winning scientist, environmentalist, and broadcaster. He's renowned for his radio and television programs that explain the complexities of the natural sciences in a compelling and accessible way. David is a geneticist and a professor emeritus at UBC, having joined our professorial ranks in the early 1960s. In 1972, he was awarded the EWR Stacey Memorial Fellowship for the outstanding research scientist in Canada under the age of 35, and he held that for 3 years. He's won numerous academic awards, holds 25 honorary degrees in Canada, the US, and Australia. He was elected to the Royal Society of Canada and is a companion of the Order of Canada. David has written 52 books and is acclaimed for his 30 years of award-winning work in broadcasting. In 1974, he developed and hosted the long-running popular science program Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio for 4 years. In 1979, he became the host of the award-winning CBC television series The Nature of Things with David Suzuki. He has won 4 Gemini Awards as best host of different Canadian television series. His 8-part television series, A Planet for the Taking, won an award from the United Nations. On June 10th, 2002, he received the John Draney Award for Broadcasting Excellence. David is recognized as a world leader in sustainable ecology. He is the recipient of UNESCO's Kalinga Prize for Science, the United Nations Environment Program Medal, UNEP's Global 500, and in 2009, he won the Right Livelihood Award, and that is considered the Alternative Nobel Prize. On November 25th at our fall convocation ceremony, UBC will confer an honorary degree on David for his contributions to the university and to global society. In return, he kindly offered to give an accessible public lecture specifically for UBC students, and I'm delighted to see so many of you here tonight. As a public speaker, he's in constant global demand, and we're extremely privileged to hear him present his lecture, The Global Eco Crisis, Is It Too Late? And before his lecture begins, I should say that David specifically asked that people not take photographs unless you can guarantee on your life that there will be no flash from your camera. So unless you can do that, no photographs. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Suzuki.
Thank you very much. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge that this is Musqueam territory, and I thank the Musqueam for taking care of it for all these millennia. I think every speaker who addresses you should indicate to you who they are speaking for and what their agenda is. I'm speaking tonight as an individual citizen, not on behalf of any organization or group. And I have to tell you, I do have an agenda. I speak as an elder who, by virtue of my age, is no longer seducible by the pull of power, money, celebrity, or even sex. Well, you can try the last one. It's okay. I'm speaking to you tonight as a grandfather, and I'm speaking on behalf of my grandchildren who will grow up in a world that my generation and the boomers leave behind for them. We have lived like kings and queens and partied as if there's no tomorrow without a thought to what we would leave to future generations. Well, the party's over, and it's time to sober up, look around and see what has to be cleaned up before we pass on. I deliberately chose a provocative title for this evening's talk because a number of leading thinkers around the world are saying that humanity has passed too many tipping points and we can't go back to a truly sustainable world. The eminent British astronomer, the Royal Astronomer, Sir Martin Rees, was recently asked on BBC what he thought the chances are that human beings will survive by the end of this century. And his answer sent a shiver up my back. He said, 50-50. James Lovelock, who coined the expression Gaia to describe the web of life on Earth, says it, by the end of this century, human beings will survive, but 90% will be gone. And Clive Hamilton, the ecological philosopher in Australia, the author of the book Affluenza, has now written a book called Requiem for a Species. And guess what species it's a requiem for? My response to those who say it's too late is that I agree we are at a very dire place, an imbalance with the atmosphere, with the biosphere. So I say to those who say it's too late, thank you very much for the urgent warning. Now please go away and shut up. Because there's no point in saying it's too late. We have to try whatever we can, and we have to do that right until the very end. And we have to do that based on hope. And I believe that we don't cling to blind optimism. The reality is, we don't know enough to say it's too late. And what gives me real hope is this. The most prized salmon species in our country is the sockeye salmon. The biggest run of sockeye salmon in the world is in the Fraser River. 2 years ago, just over 1 million sockeye returned to the Fraser, and I said to my wife, that's it. They've really had it. That's just not enough to keep on going. A year later, as you all know, we got the largest run of sockeye in the last 100 years. Don't believe any scientist that tells you he knows or she knows what's going on. We don't have a clue what the hell's going on. But what it did show is that nature can surprise us. I don't believe for a minute the sockeye are out of trouble. But what a shock that was. And maybe, just maybe, if we can pull back and give nature room, she can surprise us and be far more generous than we deserve. But let us not forget the urgency of the message that is coming to us from those who say it's too late. Now, I'm often told that we can't be too depressing. Please, David, don't be too depressing. You're going to turn everybody off. People are going to stop listening. But how can we confront the crisis to find real solutions if we don't face the facts, however terrible? You see, we are at a critical moment in all of human history. The Nobel Prize winner Paul Crutzen has said that this is the Anthropocene epoch, the moment in time when human beings have become a geological force. We are now altering the physical, the chemical, and the biological properties of the planet on a geological scale. And we have become so powerful that we are now undermining the very life support systems of the Earth. We are using air, water, and soil as a garbage can for our most toxic compounds and wastes. How can we possibly have a healthy people if we don't have a healthy planet? More than 80% of the planet's forests have been invaded and cleared for agriculture, for towns, for lumber, for pulp, and other resources, so that today there are only three large intact forests left on the planet. The largest, get this, is in Canada, the boreal forest. There's the Amazon, and there's a forest in Papua New Guinea. But if we continue as we are in 20 years, there will be no large intact forests left on Earth. The oceans that cover over 70% of the planet's surface are a mess. According to Boris Wurm at Dalhousie University, if we carry on the course we are on now, there will be no commercial species of fish left by 2050. Farm and industrial runoff is choking the rivers and lakes, running into our oceans and creating dead zones in all of the oceans of the world that are in, and these are increasing in number, duration, and size. In the oceans, in the great gyres of the Pacific and the Atlantic, stuff that ends up in the oceans is being centrifuged into the center. There are islands of plastic bigger than the state of Texas. And now with the increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, carbon is dissolving into the ocean as carbonic acid, and we are acidifying, lowering the pH of the ocean with consequences we can't even begin to know fully. How did we arrive at this moment in time? I'm a geneticist, and I've been absolutely astounded to watch scientists acquire an ability to manipulate DNA, the genetic material. And scientists today can now use their manipulative powers to trace the movement of human beings across the planet over time. And as we follow these tracks, all of the trails lead back to Africa 150,000 years ago. I can't wait to be invited by the Ku Klux Klan to give a lecture and tell them that we are all Africans and our origins. And if you think, try to imagine what the world was like 150,000 years ago when we were born as a species. There were still woolly mammoths on Earth, saber-toothed tigers. And if you think of the Serengeti, it must have been covered with animals in abundance and variety beyond anything we can imagine today. And looking back at the world when we appeared, you got to admit, we weren't very impressive. I mean, there weren't very many of us. We weren't very big or strong or fast, and we weren't endowed with sensory abilities. I'm sure no other species, when they saw us, began to tremble and whisper, "Oh my God, watch out." Survival and our success, a brain that endowed us with a massive memory, with curiosity, and with inventiveness. That brain was aware of itself in space and time. That brain remembered from past experience, learned by trial and error, kept trying out new ideas. That brain then attempted to put all of its accumulated knowledge into some kind of meaningful whole, created worldviews in which everything was connected to everything else. And throughout time, people with worldviews, when something like the birth of a two-headed child, the appearance of an albino bird, or some other spectacular event in nature wasn't dismissed as some kind of freak of nature or an accident. It was heavily pondered about. Could this be a sign that we have done something wrong and we're going to be punished for it? Or was it a portent of something extraordinary to happen? Because in a worldview, everything is connected and everything we do has consequences. And that human brain invented a novel idea called a future. The future doesn't exist. The only thing that's real is now and what we can remember from the past. But because we created the idea of a future, we are the only animal that realized we can affect the future by what we do today. Drawing on our experience and knowledge, we could project into the future and see where the dangers lie and where the opportunities were. And we could deliberately in the present choose to avoid the dangers and exploit the opportunities. I believe foresight, that ability to look ahead, was the great survival attribute of our species. That was the key to our enormous success. And that foresight enabled us to spread across the planet, to exploit many different ecosystems. And those our knowledge of the gained in these ecosystems was reflected in our language and our culture. And often we moved to new lands where we discovered new opportunities, and often we overexploited them, and we were left then with two consequences. We could either stay and try to live in a more balanced way, or we could move on to new lands. And this is the history of our species. Tim Flannery, one of his early books was called The Future Eaters, the way that we moved across the planet, eating up our future by overexploiting the lands. And so we have now occupied every continent. We even have a permanent base on Antarctica. And today, if you fly in a jet high above the Earth, miles above Earth, the main species you can see or infer the presence of is us. You can see it flying over the Rockies now in the checkerboard pattern of clear cuts. You can see it in the huge lakes stretching behind the dams. You can see it in the straight lines of roads and farmers' fields. And you can see it in the dome of haze over every big city. And at night, the planet is ablaze with the evidence of human beings. Today, we have become the most numerous mammal on the planet. There are more of us than any species of mouse, rat, or rabbit. And in becoming the most numerous mammalian species, we have now defied a biological principle that says the population of a species is inversely related to its size. What that means is the bigger you are, the fewer there can be. If you're a whale or an elephant, there can be a lot fewer of you because you need more space and resources than if you're a mouse or a rabbit. But humans are in an intermediate size, and yet there are more of us than any other mammalian species, and we've achieved that, of course, through trade and through technology. We have acquired technological prowess beyond anything any other species has known, that enable us to explore out past our solar system, that enables us to penetrate to the deepest parts of the oceans, beneath the Earth's mantle, and up to the highest mountains. And through technology, we have now been able to take vast quantities out of the Earth. And that technology then feeds an unbelievable consumptive appetite. We actually think of shopping as our recreation. It's a way we get into shape by going shopping, and we love to buy stuff, and all the stuff that we buy comes out of the earth and goes back into it when we're done with it. And we now have a global economy that drives our technology and our consumption. A global economy that uses the entire planet as a source of raw materials, that uses the entire planet as a dumping ground for its toxic chemicals and wastes. And one of the major problems with the global economy is that it now blinds us to the ecological and the social effects of the products that we are exploiting. I am sure that none of you in this room is growing a big field of cotton plants in your backyard. And yet many of us are wearing cotton shirts, cotton pants. Cotton is one of the most chemically intensive crops that we grow. But when we go to a store, do we ask, gee, where was this cotton grown? Is it organic? What was the impact of cotton growing on the local people, on the local ecosystems? No, we just want a cotton shirt, we pay our money and buy it. When you buy a car or a computer or a television set, they're filled with all kinds of metals. Mining is one of the most destructive activities we engage in. Again, do we ever ask, where did the metals in this car come from? Where were they mined, and what was the effect on the local people and the local ecosystems? No, we just want to buy a car that's reliable and affordable. We pay our money, and away we go. And yet the very act of buying a product then has repercussions that extend around the world in a global economy, but we can't see it. We're blinded to those implications. For over 40 years, the leading scientists using supercomputers have been acting in the best tradition of our species, putting in all the data they have about the state of the world, looking ahead and seeing what the consequences will be. For over 40 years, the leading scientists of the world have been warning us that we are headed down a very dangerous path, that there are alternative ways of living that would be better for us and better for our surroundings. But now we are turning our backs on the very survival mechanism, our foresight, that got us to where we are in 150,000 years. Look at Canada. For 5 years, despite everything that scientists have been saying, Canada, in the past five years, our leaders have never once said, climate change is being caused by human activity, it's real and it's urgent. The Harper government, in fact, is not interested in the knowledge and the warnings that come from scientists. He has shut down gun registration despite the testimony of the police and law enforcement officers that this is an effective way to reduce killings and accidents. He has laid off scientists in Environment Canada who are there to tell us what the state of the world is. Indeed, he has canceled the research vessels that go to the Arctic to investigate the properties and the behavior of climate change. He has muzzled scientists so that their work can be vetted through government eyes, through government ideology. He has canceled the long-form census, which is one of the best ways we have of assessing the state of Canada. He is cutting back on the CBC, our national broadcaster through which we get the most, I feel, the best kind of it, and I have a bit of vested interest, the best kind of information that we can get. He wants to build more prisons when all of the indications are that crime rates are falling. This is a government driven by ideology, not facts or information. And our government now reflects a fundamental shift in perception from the way we saw our place in the world for 99% of human existence. For most of human existence, we were a local tribal animal. We didn't have to worry about whether there were human beings on the other side of an ocean or over a mountain. We only worried about our own tribe and our tribal territory. We knew for most of human existence that we were deeply embedded in the natural world and utterly dependent on it. Even in 1900, when there were 1.5 billion people in the world, there were only 14 cities with more than 1 million people. London was the largest with 6.5 million. Tokyo was the 7th largest with 1.5 million people. The vast majority of people around the world lived in rural village communities because we were a farming species. And farmers know very well that we are utterly dependent on weather and climate, that the amount of moisture in the soil in the summer is related to how much snow we get in the winter. Farmers know that they need insects to pollinate flowering plants. They know that certain species, like the legumes, will take nitrogen from the air and fix it as fertilizer in the soil. Farmers know very well that we are embedded in and dependent on nature. But suddenly that has all changed. By the year 2000, there were now 6 billion people on the planet, but there were hundreds of cities with more than a million people. The 10 largest cities in the year 2000 all had more than 11 million people. Tokyo was the largest city with 26 million people. I just came back from Tokyo 3 days ago. Greater Tokyo is now over 35 million people. Canada's population crammed into Greater Tokyo. And if you've ever been there, you know human beings shouldn't live this way. In countries like Canada and the industrialized world, the vast majority of human beings now live in big cities. And in a big city, our perception of the world changes. I have a friend who lives in the northern suburbs of Toronto. He lives in a high-rise building that's completely air-conditioned. And he told me, he goes down the elevator in the basement, gets into his car, which is air-conditioned, drives down the Don Valley Freeway, into the downtown, into the basement of his commercial building, up into his office, completely air-conditioned. His office is connected to huge shopping malls and food markets. And he told me, David, I don't have to go outside for weeks if I don't want to. In a city, it's easy to think we're different from other creatures. We don't need nature. I mean, we create our own habitat. As long as we have a few parks out there to camp and play in, who needs nature? In a city, our highest priority is our job, because we need a job to earn the money to buy the things we want, not the things we need anymore. I was a child of survivors of the Great Depression, and they taught me, live within your means. Buy what you need, not what you want. But now, we want all kinds of stuff. And we have to work hard in order to get the money, in order to buy the stuff we want, not what we need. And so, in a city, it's clear our highest priority becomes the economy. When Prime Minister Harper says, as he has for over 5 years, we can't act to seriously reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it'll destroy the economy. He is now elevating the economy above the very atmosphere that gives us our weather and climate, above the very air that we need in order to survive. And he forgets, or perhaps he doesn't know, that the word economy comes from the Greek word ekos, meaning household or domain. Ecology is the study of home. Economics is the management of home. What ecologists try to do is determine what are the principles, the conditions, the laws that enable a species to survive and flourish. Not a bad bit of information. Now, I would have thought any corporation, any government, any group of people about to begin a big new program would say, wait a minute now. First, we have to ask those ecologists, what are those conditions? What are those principles and laws? Because we don't want to do anything that violates those conditions or those principles. But no, we elevate the economy above ecology. What comes now before anything to do with our surroundings? Let's put the eco back into economics. Let me give you some history to show you why some of my colleagues feel it's now too late. I was beginning my career as a university professor in 1962. And boy, I was ready to be a hotshot geneticist and make my mark in the world, and I was completely sidelined by a woman. And that's happened to me ever since I was a teenager. In this case, my great regret is that I never met her, but she had as big of an influence on my life as any woman I've ever known. Her name was Rachel Carson. And in 1962, she published a book called Silent Spring. and it was all about the unexpected effects of pesticides. You can't imagine the impact that book had. When her book came out, there wasn't a single department or ministry of the environment in any government on the planet. Rachel Carson put the environment on the map. And in only 10 years, by 1972, the United Nations established UNEP, the United Nations Environment Program, and held the first international conference on the environment in Stockholm. In 1984, a huge, huge step. The Montreal Protocol began a deliberate phase-out of CFCs because of the recognition of the effect on the ozone layer. In 1987, the Brundtland Commission came out with its report, Our Common Future, coined the phrase sustainable development, and warned that we had to act very, very quickly on the environmental crisis. In 1988, 300 climatologists meeting in Toronto, Stephen Harper told me, Brian Mulroney asked Stephen to chair some of the sessions. 1988, those scientists in Toronto said the evidence is in. Human use of fossil fuels is causing a change in climate. And they issued a press release at the end of the conference calling for an urgent action on the part of all governments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 20% below 1988 levels in 15 years. 1992, the Earth Summit was held in Rio. The Earth Summit was the largest gathering ever of heads of state in history and was meant to signal that henceforth human activity would always acknowledge the ecological consequences and be careful to protect the environment. And Agenda 21 was to be the great blueprint for achieving sustainable development. Agenda 21 would cost 0.7% of the annual GDPs of the industrialized world. It would cost 20% of the annual GDPs of the developing world. And yet, before the meeting was even over in 1992, the rich countries were saying that they couldn't afford to meet the financial requirements of Agenda 21. In 1995, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change met in Geneva. I was there. And they admitted for the first time, formally, that human beings indeed were affecting climate. They were very, very cautious up to that point. In 1997, the Kyoto Conference was held. I was there. And at that conference, India and China and Russia, they were all there. And everyone agreed that it was the industrialized world that had created the problem of climate change. It was our profligate use of fossil fuels that had added too much carbon to the atmosphere, that all the green things in the oceans and on land couldn't remove it fast enough, and they were accumulating. And it was agreed by everyone, since we had created the problem, it was up to the industrialized world to cap emissions and bring them down. And that would enable the developing world to grow their economies while the industrialized world was beginning to settle theirs down. And by 2012, everyone would come together and come to an agreement for all of the countries. As soon as Kyoto was over, Canadians, especially those in Alberta, began to scream, we're not going to be dictated by some international covenant. We want a made-in-Canada solution. All Kyoto did was set a target, a 6% reduction below 1990 levels by 2012. How we achieved it would be made in each country, a made-in-Canada program. Right away, Alberta said, why should we do this when China and India and all these developing countries aren't involved in this process? They were all there. We all agreed. If we, who created the problem, can't reduce our emissions, why should the developing world pay any attention to the concerns about climate change? When in 2002, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien ratified the Kyoto Protocol. He signed on. He didn't sign that as a liberal. He signed that as the Prime Minister of Canada and committed Canada to trying to meet the Kyoto targets. When it was signed or ratified by Putin in 2004, it became international law for all of the countries that had signed it. When Mr. Harper was elected Prime Minister with a minority government 5 years ago, he immediately said, I'm not going to try to even meet the Kyoto target. That's absurd. He ran, remember, every year on a law and order platform. And yet by turning Canada's back on the Kyoto Agreement, he was declaring that Canada was a renegade country, an outlaw nation for whom international law didn't matter. The government, this is our government. He's my prime minister. Although I've voted very, very carefully ever since I turned 21. I voted in every federal election. I have never voted for a party that had got into government. So I guess for all my life, my vote has been wasted because we have this stupid first-past-the-post system of voting. So our government has taken the most cynical path, not ever acknowledging that this is a serious issue to be met of climate change, and instead saying, yes, 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 we're not going to try to meet the Kyoto target, which is 6% below 1990, and all the while our emissions have been going up. We're going to set 2007 as our baseline, and we're going to try to reduce emissions down below the 2007 mark. The most cynical ploy I can imagine. Peter Kent, now our environment minister, if you heard him last week on The Current, it was embarrassing. He's whining, Canada only produces 2% of global emissions, we're trivial. Wait a minute now, we're only 0.5% of the global population. Seems to me we're producing one shitload of carbon dioxide for a rinky-dink country. And if we, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, cannot begin to seriously reduce our emissions, how dare we then demand that China, India, Indonesia, or Brazil reduce their emissions? This is like the smokers who say to their kids, do as I say, not as I do. Well, it doesn't work that way. We set the example for the rest of the world. Prime Minister Harper says that we can't reduce our emissions because we are a northern country, and it will destroy our economy to reduce our emissions. What kind of a leader is this who would tell you something that's simply not true? Sweden, if you've ever been to Sweden, they're a hell of a lot more of a northern country than we are. Sweden imposed a carbon tax in the early 1990s. Today they pay $120 a ton. Everybody bellowed and groaned about British Columbia's carbon tax of $15 a ton. Swedes pay $120 a ton. They have reduced greenhouse gas emissions 7% below 1990 levels. In other words, they're past the Kyoto target. And during that time, their economy grew by 44%. What kind of a leader is it that would deliberately lie to us that it will destroy the economy, that will deliberately put the economy above the very atmosphere, and then ignore the activities of the most polluting area in the country? The important thing now is to recognize the problems that are real and that we have to respond with urgency. And I believe once we bite the bullet and say, we got to do something, and do it on a wartime effort, as if Pearl Harbor has been bombed, then I am absolutely sure the opportunities, unexpected, will be immense. And I say this from experience. I was in my last year of college, a senior in college, in 1957. And On October 4th, 1957, we were electrified to learn that the Soviet Union had launched Sputnik. Nobody knew it was a space program. And in the months that followed, the Americans, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, all tried to launch their own individual satellites, and every rocket blew up on the launch pad. And meanwhile, the Russians announced the first animal in space, a dog, Laika, the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin, the first team of cosmonauts, the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova. And we realized, wow, are they ever advanced in science and mathematics? Americans didn't roll over and say, oh, God, it's going to cost too much, ruin the economy to try to catch up to the Russians. They began to pour money. When John Kennedy in 1961 announced we're going to race the Russians to the moon, it was a very exciting time. And I can tell you, as a science student, I was working in the, going to school in the United States, and even though I was a Canadian, all you had to do was say, oh, I like science, and they threw money at you. It was a glorious time. And think of the consequence of that American commitment. Not only are the Americans the only ones to land people on the moon, but think of all of the unexpected things that came out of that. And it's not just Tang. We know that we've got cell phones, we've got 24-hour-a-day news channels, we've got all kinds of technology that has resulted, and probably the internet too, resulted as a consequence of just making the commitment to beat the Russians to the moon. And that's what I think is the opportunity that lies. I mean, you think of solar panels now that are so inefficient. Huge opportunity. You think of batteries. You think of all kinds of alternative sources of energy, geothermal, and all of these things that offer an opportunity, not an impediment to a pollution-free future. In a democracy, we elect people to represent and lead us into the future. Well, we know that our governments do not represent us. If our governments truly represent us, about 55% would be women, about 3% would be First Nations, and a very large percent would be visible minorities and homosexuals, and there would be a much different distribution in our government if it was truly representative. Many years ago, I did a study of our elected representatives in Ottawa. This is back in the 1970s. And I found that the members of the cabinet, 70% came from two areas. They come from business and they come from law. Now, I believe that that disproportionate representation of business people and lawyers skews government priorities. No wonder they're so bloody concerned constantly with issues jurisdictional or issues economic, because it reflects their primary interest. We need a much broader spectrum of people to represent us. We need more people from labor. We need more teachers and doctors and all kinds of areas of society represented. I believe the problem is that lawyers and business people are probably the two groups well-connected to funders, and they can afford to run for office and lose. Most of us can't imagine running for office and taking on the big debt if we lose. You know that corporations are not people. And yet corporations by far contribute the largest amount of money to politicians running for office. Rich people disproportionately put their money on people running for office. And I believe that's a large part of what the Occupy movement is going around the world right now. It's the fact that in democracies like ours, we don't really have governments that are now running according to an agenda for the public, because as you well know, whoever pays the piper calls the tune. Our government officials sound like cheerleaders for the corporate sector. Well, what the hell do we expect? They're putting most of the money into campaigns. Let's take our government back and have real democracy. Let's let it represent us. I I think that what we have to do is ban all corporate and individual contributions to political campaigns. I believe that every qualified person who wants to run for office should be subsidized from government revenue. In other words, any candidate then would be limited in how much they could spend on a campaign, and they would be beholden to the taxpayer, to the general public. And that's what we need, a radical reform in which we take back our democracy. While governments operate from an agenda of corporate priorities, then we see increasingly the pressure to pull back on corporate taxes, to decrease the regulations, and to put more and more faith in small government and letting the market forces rule. This is absolutely nuts! We live in a world that is constrained by laws that scientists dig out. In physics, we know there are laws that constrain the way we can live. E equals mc squared tells us that we can't build a rocket faster than the speed of light. I know at CERN they say 6 kilometers faster than the speed of light, but I'll wait on that. I'm still a skeptic. But we know that there are limits to how fast a rocket you can build. You know that you can't build an anti-gravity machine here on Earth. We know that the first and second laws of thermodynamics say you can't build a perpetual motion machine. Those are laws of physics, and we live within the world constrained by them. There are laws of chemistry, diffusion constants, reaction rates, molecular properties that dictate the kinds and the speeds and the quantities of chemical reactions that we can carry out. And in biology, we know that our biological nature dictates we have an absolute need for clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean energy, and biodiversity. These are critical to our survival. We can't change those. Those are laws of nature. Other things, like capitalism, like corporations, like economies, currency, markets, these are not forces of nature, for heaven's sakes. We invented them. And if they don't work, or we think something's wrong, we can change them. You can't change what our laws or forces of nature, but we can sure as hell change these kinds of institutions. And that's what I believe, the Robin Hood tax or the so-called Tobin tax, these kinds of things are readily available to begin to reform the kinds of economic systems that we have. In the economic system, I believe, is the primary driver of ecological destruction around the world, because it's simply the economic system is not grounded in reality. For years, I and many others have fought against the practices of clear-cut logging in British Columbia. We weren't against logging, we were just interested in having logging that was sustainable forever. In British Columbia, they tell us, the forest experts tell us, trees add fiber, that is, they grow, at about 2% a year. Well, you don't have to be a genius to know that if you cut 2% or less of your trees by volume a year, you can cut trees forever. That's sustainable forestry. But the economics says, that's crazy. Why would you do that? Why would you take only 2% of your investment every year? If you clear-cut them, take the money and put it in the bank, you can make 5 or 6%. If you clear-cut them, put the money into Indonesia or Papua New Guinea, you probably make 30 or 40%. And when the trees run out, money doesn't stand for anything anyway, so you put it in fish. The fish can run out, put it in computers. Money doesn't represent anything except itself. Today, you and I can buy money, hold that money, then sell that money, and make money. Can you believe that? Money represents itself. And money grows faster than real things. When we were fighting in a number of watersheds across British Columbia, we were always coming up against the argument, you got to be realistic. The bottom line is the economy. So what's the value of protecting these forests? Forest companies could say, oh yeah, well, it'll give this many jobs, this much profit, this much volume of timber or pulp. What do you stack up against that? And we have to say, well, maybe some tourists will come in and look around, and maybe we can find some berries that we can sell, and maybe even if we're lucky, we'll find a medicine that we can... But the real value of the forest, of course, we can't use as an argument. As long as that forest is intact and healthy, it's taking carbon dioxide out of the air, putting oxygen back. Not a bad service for an animal like us. If all the green things weren't doing that, we wouldn't be alive. And yet, economists are so clever, they dismiss that as an externality. I didn't know that was an economic term or expression. It just means we don't give a shit about that. It doesn't count in our system here. Those trees are pumping millions of gallons of water out of the soil, transpiring it into the air, and modulating weather and climate. That's an externality. All of the inhabitants in the forest many of the inhabitants go to pollinate flowering plants. That's an externality. Those tree roots are clinging to the soil, preventing it from eroding into the salmon beds, spawning beds, and preventing the eggs from hatching. That's an externality. That forest provides habitat to countless plants, animals, and microorganisms. All those things the forest, the intact forest, is doing to keep the planet habitable and healthy for an animal like us are disregarded by our economic system. And that's why the economic system continues to drive our destructiveness. Our problem, I think, is that... what we do then is we compound the problem with this economy by letting economists design measures that indicate how well our society is doing. A few years ago, it used to be the GNP, the gross national product. There are reasons why it was abandoned to the GDP, the gross domestic product. And I won't go into the complexities of that, but it has to do with international trade. Anyway, the GDP measures any exchange of money for goods and services, all adds up. And boy, you know, governments and corporations live and die by what the GDP does from month to month. And everything is trying to drive the GDP to keep growing. But you know that the GDP is one of the nuttiest measures you can imagine, because it only adds. All it does is measure the exchange of money for goods and services. It doesn't ask why. So when there was an ice storm in Quebec a few years ago that knocked out electricity for some people for up to 6 weeks, it cost $1.5 billion to clean up the mess. The finance minister of Quebec a year later said, hey, the GDP grew by $1.5 billion. So the ice storm was a great boom. You know what? Fukushima, I just came back from Japan. Fukushima is a disaster you cannot imagine. But the GDP of Japan is going to have a huge jump. This is the nuttiest thing you can imagine. And things that are really important, like being a full-time parent, like volunteering, like helping out your neighbor without an exchange of money, those things are absolutely ignored, and yet they are the glue that keeps our society together. So what the hell is the GDP measuring, and yet every government, every corporation is going through contortions in order to keep that thing growing? Our problem is, I believe, at its heart, that we have adopted what biologists call an anthropocentric vision of the world. We think that the anthropo, us, we are at the center of the action, and everything revolves around us. And so we often hear speak of the triple bottom line, which is indicated by a series of circles. This bottom line is the environment. This bottom line is the economy. And this one is society. And they're all equal size, and they intersect, they overlap. And where the area of overlap is our opportunity to do things there that will benefit all three, the triple bottom line. This is the biggest hoax going? I mean, this is crazy. You mean the economy is the same size as the environment? You mean the economy is the same size as society? And yet that's what this whole triple bottom line idea indicates. There is another way of seeing our place in the world. It's called biocentric, that we are just a part of a much more complex web of living things, and we are utterly dependent on the rest of the web for our well-being and survival. And in a biocentric view, the way I would describe it is there's one great big circle, and that's the biosphere. That's the zone of air, water, and land where all life exists. And inside that big circle are about 10 to 30 million smaller circles of different size. And they overlap in different ways. So those are the species of plants, animals, and microorganisms that inhabit the biosphere. Unfortunately, one of those circles within the biosphere now occupies 40% of the area of the big circle, and that's us. We have now taken over 40% of what's called the net primary productivity of the planet. Solar energy absorbed in photosynthesis by plants, we have either co-opted by taking it for us or destroying the ability. And as we do that, we drive countless species out of existence. But that's the reality, the big circle, then the smaller circles, and within the 40% that's us, the economy should be a much smaller circle. That's the reality, and when you look at it that way, you see that the human society circle has got to be shrunk way down, and the economy has got to be shrunk much, much more. We've come to think that the economy is everything and that its well-being is what we are dependent on. And we must have growth forever in that economy if we are to stay healthy. And we forget that the economy is not the end. The economy is just a tool. It's a means to something else. We've come to act as if the economy is the be-all and end-all, and everything must service it. It reminds me of the generations in the past that believed in dragons and demons. And man, they thought they were real, and they would do anything just to keep them off their backs. And now we treat the economy, another human invention, we treat it the same way people treated dragons and demons. We think it's real, and oh my God, we've got to keep serving it and keeping it growing. If we don't keep it happy and growing, we're in deep trouble. The economy is just a means to something else. What does it mean to be a Canadian? What are we proud of? And what do we want Canada to be in 30 years? Then we should be asking, how the hell do we get the economy to help us realize those objectives? Rather than throwing everything out in order to keep this economy growing forever. There is a book that I'm just about finished now that I urge all of you to read. The book is called, What is an Economy For Anyway? And it poses a lot of fundamental questions about this crazy economy. We are caught up in a delusion that the economy, this flawed human construct, is the center of our existence, that we must serve it and keep it growing forever, which is not possible. But in order to do that, we want to cut social services. We want to, and all of those services that help us live happier, healthier lives, we want to cut these in order to serve the economy. Somehow, it seems to me, we've got everything ass backwards here. I'd like to end my talk with just two personal stories. Tara and I, my wife and I, have lived in the same house in Vancouver, in Kitsilano, for 35 years. In the 1990s, this must have been the 1980s, before Hong Kong reverted to China, we got a letter from a real estate agent, and it said, offshore money is pouring into Vancouver. Now is a good time for you to sell your house and buy up. I never heard the expression buy up. I thought you got a home and you stayed in it forever and passed it on to your children. I didn't know. It's just a starter home and we got to get a bigger one or something else. I mean, what a crazy idea that is. Really kind of pissed me off when I got this letter. But I thought, okay, I live in a very wonderful place. I'm right on the water in Kitsilano near the kids' pool. And I thought, if I were to put this on the market, what would I put down as the things that give that place, my property, its value? And the first thing I did was I put down the fact that when we bought the house, I couldn't afford it. It was $135,000. And I asked my father and mother-in-law to kick in some money and said, I'll move you in when you retire. And I did that, and Grandma and Granddad have lived upstairs for my children for their entire lives. And I put that down as high value. My father was a cabinet maker, and when Tara and I were first married, he built a kitchen cabinet in our apartment. When I bought this house, I ripped out the cabinet and put it in our kitchen. It looks doesn't fit at all, but every time I use that cabinet, I think of my father, and I put that down. And under the dogwood tree in the back, my children have dragged roadkill off the street. You know, there are snakes and birds, and we buried our pet dog there. And we have an animal cemetery in the backyard, and I put that down. And when my father-in-law is an avid gardener, and he knew that I love asparagus and raspberries, and he's planted a little patch of raspberries and asparagus just for me, and I put that down. And as I began to make this list, I realized those things that make this more than a piece of real estate or property, that make that place my home, those are priceless to me. And yet on the market, they are worthless. And that's one of the problems we have with this crazy economy. The things that matter most to us have no value. My great hero, my teacher, my mentor, my critic, was my father. And in 1994, my father was dying of cancer. I was grateful that it wasn't painful. He knew he was dying, and he was totally prepared. He wasn't afraid. I moved in with him the last month to take care of him. And that last month was one of the happiest times I spent with my father. We laughed, we cried. At night, my wife would come over with the kids, and we'd show slides of trips we took. And he would say over and over, David, I'd die a rich man. He wasn't rich in money. But over and over as we talked, he never once said, do you remember that closet full of fancy clothes? Do you remember that big car I owned in London, Ontario? Or do you remember that house we had on Bruffdale Lane? No, we never once talked about that. All he talked about were family, friends, and neighbors, and the things we did together. That was my father's wealth. And indeed, he died a very, very wealthy man. We've got diverted off into a world in which we think stuff, in which we think this economy is the source of everything that matters. And I would say we've got a lot of change needed, and the big change that happens has got to be in our heads. It's got to be in the way that we see the world and our place in it. And then we begin to change our behavior and those things that we can change. Is it too late? I would never say that's too late. Indeed, right to the last minute, I would not say it's too late. But it is very, very late. And the challenge and the solutions, I believe, lie in our brains. And there are huge opportunities that lie in this global eco-crisis. We simply have to seize the moment and then get on with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Stick around,
Well, that was David Suzuki. That was a recording of David Suzuki speaking at the Chan Center on November 3rd, 2011. This recording was of a lecture called The Global Eco Crisis, Is It Too Late? And Dr. Suzuki gave that lecture at the Chan Center. This recording was funded by the Office of the Vice President, Research and International, and the Office of the Provost and the UBC Sustainability Initiative. On November 25th,